You're listening to a Countout Podcast.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair has got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Nashville Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Everybody, and welcome to The Ballot, the only show where the Hall of Fame conversation starts first. I'm your host, Ryan Eitze. That's an opening I've never done on the show before, but I'm doing it now for the first time. Thank you, everybody, for joining us on The Ballot. Thank you, everybody, for joining us in March. We got a whole nother discussion about a whole nother new candidate, first-time candidate, on the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. Joining me today, a returning guest, the first ever returning guest on the Ballot series, is a Voice of Wrestling writer, is article writer, is sometimes podcast guest on various other podcasts. And of course, a Matt Hardy super fan, Adam Berger. Adam, welcome back to the Ballot. I'm so happy to bring you back on for this season.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about some of the candidates and specifically Drew McIntyre today. And I forgot about that Matt Hardy conversation until just now. So thank you for reminding me of that.
How can I remind you about your favorite wrestler of all time? That's crazy.
I forgot I revealed that. So yeah, okay. I'm a Mattitude follower. I gotta live up to those principles today.
That is true. That is true. We'll see if we can find out any more fun, new, interesting favorite wrestlers of yours this time around. But yes, you're coming back for another new episode. Like you said, we're discussing Drew McIntyre today. Obviously, he is making the ballot for the first time in his history as a professional wrestler. Last year, I had you on to the show discussing Bray Wyatt. And obviously, Bray Wyatt has fell off immediately, which is, you know, whatever, that's fine. But now we are here discussing a new person with Drew McIntyre. I guess same question I ask everybody, same question I've already asked you about Bray Wyatt. I'll ask you about Drew McIntyre. Adam, what is your sort of connection, your relationship to Drew McIntyre?
Yeah, Drew's an interesting one because he's someone... Like, I've watched his major league career for its entirety. So, you know, a lot of these candidates, when, you know, you're a Hall of Fame voter, you got to do research on them or either entirely because you've never heard of them before, like especially if you're voting in historical or rest of the world. Mm-hmm. But even for modern candidates, like, I mean, some of the modern candidates go back a couple decades or might have periods of their career where their work is highly regarded, but you might have missed a lot of that potentially. So you want to, you know, go back and watch to acclimate yourself with it. But Drew's someone, there's a little bit of that with him, which we might get into, but
sure.
He's someone who's basically like, you know, I haven't seen much from before he was in WWE, but from his career, like, you know, in 2009 when he debuts in WWE until modern day, someone, you know, I've followed regularly in real time.
Yeah, I felt the same way. You know, obviously, there are those people where you have to do a bunch of research. Obviously, first episode this season was all about Ted Boy Marino. And that's a guy that not only did I have to do a bunch of research on, but a guy I've literally never heard of in my life popping up on the ballot. And I think, like we said in the episode, I think it's most people probably have never heard of Ted Boy Marino. Whereas Drew McIntyre is completely different. He's a guy that has been around for... a while now, obviously in WWE for a good portion of his career. Then he left, traveled the indies, was in TNA, Impact for a while, and he's returned to WWE. In I based on what you're saying, I think we agree his return to WWE is basically the peak of his career, coming in at NXT first all the way to now is sort of the bulk peak of his career. I think if there's any sort of Hall of Fame consideration, it's mainly gonna be that section. I don't think we'll get much in terms of the indies and TNA. We have discussions, and I think obviously the sort of mid-card, lower mid-card run he had previously in WWE is, we just kind of shuffle that over to the side. But that's there is an interesting aspect of that I find interesting. I think he's a fascinating candidate. I think he is an interesting person to be added to the list. I guess we'll just go through the various different categories of ballot induction that Dave has laid out. You will start, I guess, with working ability, something that is, I think, probably his strongest, in my opinion. I find him to be a really good wrestler, but I'd love to know what you think about Drew McIntyre and his in-ring. And I guess his promo work as well, now that he has won an Observer Award for... No, he didn't win for best promo, but he won it for best feud. So there's something there.
No, he did. He won it for best interview.
He beat The Rock. Yep. He's better than The Rock officially.
Officially. Yeah. He won number one best interview this past year, even over The Rock. Rock won most charismatic, but Drew was the number one best interview.
Most charismatic is what I was thinking of, but yes.
Yeah. And then he also had, to your point, he won a feud of the year for his feud with CM Punk. They were number five in match of the year for their Hell in a Cell match. And then, I think that was it for, I always track the top fives anyway, for the Observer Awards. When you get to 10, like there's not a whole lot of votes for some of those, like number 10. You're going to get some weird stuff sneaking in, in the bottom. But for the major ones, the top five, it's all, people who did like a lot of really great work that's, recognized by the Observer readers, who tend to, it's always going to have a Western and English speaking bias, think, to them. But at least for those, fans who watch a lot of wrestling, it's always an accomplishment. It means that to me that the wrestler did something that resonated and was really high level. So honestly, that's like the best year of his career. Like the only other top five placement that I tracked for a major award was in 2020. He was number five for best wrestler of the year. So honestly, like this past year's like that's the biggest strength of his case, because he had such a great year, and it was at, the biggest promotion in the world when they were doing really well. That's really like that's why it's so interesting with him, because he's coming off the best year of his career, and this is when he goes on the ballot. So I know some people they want the ballot to have like a certain, like a really high standard just to get added to it in the first place. And I think I'm a little bit more liberal with that. I'm fine with like all the like biggest names of their various eras getting a shot. And then hey, if they fall off, then that's what the process is for, right? Mm-hmm. Before this year, I might have had a bit of like, hey, really? Is he really worthy of being on it? But this past year, I'll say like if he has like, a handful of similar years to that one, then I think he could potentially be like a really serious contender for it. But I'll say with the past year at least, I think he's definitely someone who's worth talking about and discussing and breaking down and worthy of consideration.
Yeah, I totally agree that his past year's his best, obviously Observer Awards respond to that as well. Other various award sites put him over as well. Voice of Wrestling had a match of the year, I believe, in top five, I think. Definitely top 10.
He was up there.
Yes. Yeah. He was definitely the highest WWE match, for sure. It is his best year for sure, both in ring and promo especially. I think he really upped his promo game this year as well, and just I guess overall wrestling character work and all that stuff really up this year. And then obviously he brought up 2020 being another big year for him. The obvious caveat is that the majority of his big year is simply in the Thunderdome. I think he has two world title reigns during 2020 going, I think, into 2021. And he, I believe, is never champion in front of a crowd, I think, other than entering the arena as champion, if I'm not mistaken. But ultimately, a big milestone career for him that is sadly just one of those things that I think throws everyone in for a loop for the Hall of Fame discussion of how do we calculate the COVID years? So, but I,
yeah,
it's a tough one for him, I guess.
Yeah. And I know, I think you introduced in-ring, but as natural, I'm just going to derail it and see where it takes us. Hey,
I set up a rail. I don't care if it gets thrown off. That's fine.
But I think that's interesting from, especially from like, just talking about his overall candidacy and his drawing case, like,
yeah,
it's tough that his reign, like that was supposed to be his big thing, right? Where he's, you know, like, I think I have him, like, you could argue he's in the main event of, like, about 20 pay-per-views or something like that, or yep, PLEs or whatever. But then when you look at, like, how many of them were in front of COVID crowds, it's, like, almost half, basically.
Yeah.
So it's, like, how do you weigh that? Like, they're obviously, like, it's not his fault necessarily that their popularity was in freefall then, because nobody liked watching COVID wrestling, right? And there was no attendance, right? And then your point, like, literally, I think the only, he won the Royal Rumble in front of a crowd, but then that he won it at the pandemic WrestleMania where he beat Brock, which was just at the PC.
Yeah.
And then he loses it to Lashley a year later, which they did have a crowd there for that. But yep, then he headlined a couple other pay-per-views against Lashley after that, but they were in the Thunderdome. And yep, then he's like the end of, like, basically, like, literally once he's out of the main event scene, that's when they start, like, going back to crowds.
Yeah.
Again, so he, that poor guy, man, just like the worst timing imaginable for his big run there.
It's almost, in terms of the sort of milestone championship runs, it's almost Shingo-esque, you know, where it's just sort of like, you know, when you look at that case, it is like, well, all of it kind of, especially the drawings aspect of it, all of it happens pretty much inside the Thunderdome. Obviously, he becomes WWE World Heavyweight Champion again at WrestleMania in front of people, but then holds the title for, I think, what, 10 minutes? So we're also going to throw that out, basically. So it's the situation where he is, in terms of drawing, it's a very difficult thing. At the end of the day, you can maybe go off of TV ratings for him, but that is something that I think historically has not really been done from many people in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame voting body. And even then, it is during the Vince McMahon era where, you know, ratings are kind of sliding a little bit. So that's just the difficulty there as well.
Yeah, because really that pandemic period is when he starts headlining. Like he was part of a six-man tag at Fastlane 2019 against The Shield, or he was in 2019, he was in the Money in the Bank match too. But like that's it really from before. Like, and he wasn't a headliner before he got elevated into that one in 2020 and won that Royal Rumble. And then, you know, after the pandemic, which, you know, extends through the first half of 2021, like, I mean, he did, like, the next year, 2022, like, okay, he had the big Clash at the Castle, right? I think that's actually probably his, like, crowning jewel, but part of that is just WWE hadn't done a show like that in Europe in forever.
And I believe that was the first one they did in decades, yes. So I think that added to it as well. So it's the tough aspect of who do I give the credit to sort of situation of modern WWE.
Yeah. Yeah, he was who they chose to headline that. So, I mean, obviously he warrants some credit for that to some degree anyway. Okay. You know, I don't think you can say he does everything, but, you know, he was Roman's opponent for that show. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody expected that too, like when they were buying the tickets. I think, okay, like, maybe they didn't know that, but they probably thought, hey, Drew's going to have a big match. You know, he's probably going to be in the main event or co-main event or something. So that probably did motivate some people to buy the tickets. So he deserves some credit for that. But then, I mean, after that, like, I guess later that year, he's in the Survivor Series War Games match. But then it's really like a whole year between, you know, like headlining programs for him, because he spent most of 2023, like, feuding with Gunther. for the IC title. So, I mean, it's really like that, I guess, that feud with the Bloodline that he had in 2022. And then basically like the Punk comes back through like their next year, he's challenging for the secondary world title, but he does headline some of those shows. And then his feud with Punk, like you can argue, whether that was the primary drawing card for like SummerSlam or if it was Cody versus Solo.
Roman's return, I heard.
Roman is coming back. Roman's coming back. But I would say like those are the two, biggest matches anyway. So he deserves some credit for that. And hey, like doing over 50,000 for SummerSlam, like that's, SummerSlam, it's not like Mania where it's historically been a stadium show forever, like that's definitely, that's the feather in his cap for sure. And then, it's like the Bad Blood show as well. Did really well. And that was the most anticipated match for that show. I would say so. Yeah. I mean, it's really just the last year. Like if he had a lot more years like this past year, I would say, yeah, definitely like you could make a drawing case for him, right? Like if he had a handful of those types of years, but it's really just this past year and the pandemic run. So like when you talk about drawing, it's really tough to, it's really tough to say like, yeah, no, this is his, like he meets that criteria. He has something to offer in the category, but I don't think you can say he meets that criteria.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think at the end of the day, especially post-pandemic, he's sort of been slotted down upper mid-card level in terms of drawing, obviously going against Gunther for the IC title and everything and sort of feuding non-title feuds of Punk. I agree that like drawing-wise, this year is probably the best. And obviously a lot of that has to do with the pairing of Punk. But at the end of the day, there's also the other aspect of like, well, Punk's also not in the Hall of Fame as well. And I think some voters, I don't know if you know this, Punk's not in the Hall of Fame. I think some voters might look towards voting towards Punk for other various reasons. And I agree, when it comes to McIntyre, he is a big part of that as well. And I think in a lot of ways, he helped put that feud over significantly, even if bracelets got involved. But it is, at the end of the day, that's pretty much it. I wouldn't consider that a Hall of Fame level drawing case. It is one of those things. I tend to agree. If he is able to have that level of run, with other people, I think I think there's difficulty because he was with Punk, especially on Punk's like return feud based for a year basically, but that's fine. I think if he is able to do that for a couple more years, then yeah, I definitely think there is more consideration there. But there is Punk and then there's other people, and who's going to be the X factor? I think at the end of the day, is it going to be Drew McIntyre? It remains to be seen, but right now I'll say, Adam, that I think it's probably Punk that probably going to put that over the edge, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like, you don't have to preach to me about CM Punk being a draw.
this year only helped.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I voted for him the last few years. I think he's an obvious Hall of Famer and probably one of the, at least, him and Cody, I expect them both to go in this year. But I would say, it takes two though to make a difference like that, especially to, potentially overshadow the world title program that exists. That's not something that happens that often. It does happen, but not that often in WWE. So yeah, I mean, and Punk was hurt too. Drew kept that feud alive with his promos, really kept it going. I'd say he definitely deserves credit for that. Maybe it's not quite 50-50, but maybe closer to like a 60-40 split than the Roman versus Solo or Cody versus Solo. matches,
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I do agree that he's definitely a big part of that, especially compared to other feuds at SummerSlam. I definitely agree that he's part of it. I think it's like the end of the day, it's just going to be the more evidence will come out in terms of what percentages you want to give it as the years go on, especially now that he's been shuffled off to SmackDown. And you know, for you know, for added star power, I guess you can say, for SmackDown, and see where he can go with feuds from there. You know, obviously, I think you brought up a great point. Basically, if we're going to tie it back into wrestling ability, having that promo ability to basically keep a feud alive for, I don't remember how many months, but several months while one guy is completely injured. Obviously, you know, Punk is no slouch in terms of the promo compartment, and he can certainly cut promos despite the injury. But the fact that he's able to win over The Rock, right, over CM Punk, of last year, I think showcases how much he adds to that sort of that drawing ability of their feud, especially it then becoming feud of the year. Now, I think this year is a good year for his mic work. I think previous years have been fine to good. I think that's fine. And then in terms of wrestling ability, I think he's a really good wrestler. I am a fan of Drew McIntyre, generally speaking. I do enjoy his work. And I think his work for the past couple of years has been really, really solid. I've at times greatly enjoyed it. I mean, like you said, at the highest he got previously in 2020 was fifth place for the Fez Flair Award, and fourth place actually for US and Canada MVP as well that year. So he does have a good case in terms of wrestling ability. But beyond that, what else do you think Drew McIntyre might bring to the table?
His wrestling ability is interesting because he's always been someone, well, I should say since 2014 or so, when he was released from WWE, like, he had potential early on, but then, I mean, his mid-card push even only really lasted for like a year and a half in WWE. And it wasn't like he did anything incredible. Like, you know, he did some good stuff and he had potential, but then the last like 3 years of his run, he's, you know, like, either just floating, or like he had like a losing streak storyline that I remember. Mm-hmm. Like, he got squashed. I think there was a Royal Rumble where he got squashed by Brodus Clay in like 2 minutes. Like, that's bad. And then he's in 3MB for multiple years. So honestly, like, his comeback from that is extraordinary. Like, I don't remember anyone else doing anything like that. Like, someone that WWE just completely jobbed out and gave up to that degree. Where, sure, like, there's been people who they've released who have come back, but someone that they just completely like killed their credibility for years and then just let them go, like, to come back and make it to the main event. Like, it's inspirational, honestly.
I mean, I will just say, Cody Rhodes.
They never killed Cody. They never killed Cody that bad.
Like, I would agree. I think if at best Cody Rhodes probably gotten down to the low mid card with like a Stardust. I don't think he ever got basically was a jobber, as you said, with Drew McIntyre.
Well, he also quit. They didn't fire. Like, they didn't want to get rid of him. He left because he was like, I don't see any upward mobility. But they might have like kept him around forever if he didn't care, right? Like, they might have just kept him around forever in spots like that. He'd still be doing Stardust and R-Truth like segments or something potentially.
But yeah, I definitely think he's gotten better in that bounce back. And developing himself on the indie scene, and I guess we can say in TNA as well, and I guess European scene as well, really helped him a lot significantly, not just in terms of wrestling ability. I think the additional strength and pounds and all that stuff he's added was able to add into his working ability to be more of a powerhouse kind of guy. I think that kind of helps him out a lot. I feel like he was more of an all-around guy beforehand, but putting on some more mass, adding into that powerhouse mobility kind of wrestler really added to that. And then being able to come back and be able to put that on the bigger stage in WWE, I think really is really solid. It is really solid, really commendable. I definitely agree with that.
He worked with, I think he also just being, he joined WWE relatively early in his career. Like, I know he started training young and he wrestled for a while before he got to WWE. So it wasn't like as short as it might seem based on his age. But I mean, he's in WWE for a long time, and they really hammer, especially back then, they really had like a specific style they wanted people to work. And then when he's in the you know, like working in Evolve, for example, you know, and he's working with Tony Nese and Chris Hero and Roderick Strong and honestly, a lot of guys he ends up working with a few years later in different places. Tommy End at the time, we know with Malachi Black now. Just like all sorts of different people. It's Ricochet, I think, too.
Gargano as well.
Gargano. I was going to say, like, we were talking about him as a worker. I forgot to, like, reference my stats that I love to use where Cage Match has him at 36, I think for a minimum of 20 votes. Cage Match has him at 36 matches rated 8 or above and three of them over 9. One of them is a match against Johnny Gargano that I've never seen before from 2015. So I gotta find that one and look that up now. Actually, the WWE Vault YouTube channel just posted like 2 hours of Drew McIntyre matches from Evolve. I guess because Evolve's coming back now. So get some cross promotion going there. So I'm actually going to check that out to see if there's anything that like stands out in that. But and then, you know, Dave Meltzer has him at, I have 58 like 4-star matches or above. So he's got some, you know, it's not the highest, you know, when you compare him to someone like Sami Zayn who fell off the ballot last year, he doesn't compare to him in that respect, but you know, that's clearly like a lot of like really good work too that a lot of people rated very highly. So it's not like I think this is an interesting one. It's like, is he a Hall of Fame level performer? I've never really thought of him that way, but it's not, when you look at it closer, it's like, oh, you know, he might not be that far off from it. And maybe if he does have like a handful of more years of doing great work, and especially if he like keeps up like his, you know, top tier promo mobility as well, you know, maybe, you know, like a few years from now, you can make that case a little bit more strongly.
I think it is, in my opinion, I think his like his output in terms of matches is a good solid level where if he has other even better cases in other categories like drawing or historical significance, then I think it could make him more of a Hall of Fame consideration overall. Like I think there are a lot of people where he has similar level of output with a lot of other wrestlers that are even on the ballot. Mm-hmm. I think it's just, you know, we'll get to obviously more of it, but I think it is the sort of level that he needs additional support and elsewhere, in other places. I looked for that Gargano match. I couldn't find it. The fact that it was at, what was it, WWN Live, I'm sure it's somewhere collecting dust potentially. I know I was able to find a Roderick Strong match in Evolve online. But yeah, that Gargano match I can't find anywhere at all. Go ahead.
I was gonna say it might be in that Evolve compilation because I think WWN was connected with. I don't know. I saw at least one Roderick Strong match in that that Evolve compilation. So there might be some great stuff in there. I wasn't able to check it out before we were talking today. But I'll definitely do that. And yeah, I want to find that Gargano match too because I'm just intrigued by what that looks like exactly, especially like in 2015, it was like what that looks like with 2015 Johnny Gargano against 2015 Drew McIntyre.
I'll say it was pretty good. That also just made me think. They did a WWE NXT YouTube page where they started like uploading all the NXT like premium live events and various shows of NXT. I wonder if they're gonna do like a WWE Evolve page and up and finally like mass upload this sort of backlog of Evolve. I don't know if we'll fully. I'm not sure if we'll get it, but I would love that. No, I don't think you can watch it anywhere.
There's Evolve on Peacock, I think, or at least it used to be on the network.
But I don't think it's all of it, or at least it was all of it.
Yeah, it's probably not all of it. Like they had, there was a lot of Evolve.
Oh yeah. But yeah, I think, like I said, he has a really good case. And like I said, I do really enjoy his work. And I think that you almost need a little bit more of it, but I think you also need more credentials in other spaces. You know, we talked about drawing power. it's tough to really sort of maybe put something together for him. So maybe that's not the place. So let's look towards historical significance, obviously historical significance in a positive manner. How do you think Drew McIntyre does in that sort of category?
Yeah, there's a couple people always interpret this in a lot of different ways, which I think is fair. I think there's a lot of different ways to interpret historical significance. So one is, okay, like, did they change the industry in some way, like either business wise or in terms of like being like an innovative worker where they influenced, you know, like future generations of wrestlers in terms of like how they wrestled, right? I don't think you can really say that with Drew. You know, not to say he's a bad worker or anything. Like, we just talked about how much we liked him. But I mean, it's hard to work like Drew McIntyre because not too many people look like Drew McIntyre. So, but he's very good, obviously. But yeah, it doesn't really have that, you know, kind of influence like, you know, Hayabusa or Grant Hamada, who just passed away recently, does. So, you know, doesn't compare to them in that respect. Okay, it's like that in that respect. And then in terms of like impacting the industry, like just like, okay, like, you know, Becky Lynch is on the ballot currently. So obviously, you know, there's a case that she, you know, really changed things for women in female wrestlers in the US by achieving what she did in WWE, which was, you know, unprecedented. And then you also have, you know, Hall and Nash, the Outsiders, like they're on the ballot, obviously. Without the, you know, without them in the NWO, like, is there even an Attitude Era? You know, who knows? But then also without them, maybe WCW doesn't die. I mean, I think it would have anyway, but they deserve both credit and blame. I think more credit, I think more positives than negatives there. Sure. You know, I'm an advocate for them, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. Drew, I'll just say Drew doesn't, you know, looking at it from those two lenses, like he doesn't really fit the tick the box for any of that. So it's like, okay, is he, as a worker, is he like significant in terms of just how great he was? Like, was he like the best worker in the world for any period of time? It's like, no, I don't really see that. He's very good, but not quite at that level.
Yeah.
You know, he was the best promo last year, which is great. So, but you know, that's the first time he's ever, you know, really been recognized at that level. So, yeah. And then in terms of drawing, like, you know, he's had a great year this past year, but you know, even that year, you know, as you mentioned, like Punk, Cody, Roman, The Rock was around, like he's not necessarily at the top of the list when it comes to the reasons for that, you know, that I guess if you want to call it a boom period, which, you know, I think that's valid, but this, you know, very high level business, you know, popularity. And he wasn't the one who like caused that either, right? He was, you know, part of the ensemble cast that kind of kept it going, helped it reach you know, new heights, but he wasn't, you know, that's more Cody, you know, and the Bloodline when you look back at what really kicked that off. So I would say historical significance, that's probably his weakest one, honestly, like if I'm looking at this. So overall, I'd say like he's a candidate who has something to offer in drawing and work, but he doesn't clearly meet either of those criteria. So it makes it tough to say like he's worthy of induction, at least right now. You know, he just had the best year of his career. So in the future, who knows? But yeah, I'd say right now, he's not someone that I would vote for.
You said two words there that I think really sum up Drew McIntyre in a lot of ways. And that was ensemble cast. I think, like, you know, I in the past year, like doing a lot of these shows and talking to various different people and really thinking about the Hall of Fame, something I've sort of come around to describing the historical significance category is like someone that is important or maybe mentioned a lot or whatever in the canon of professional wrestling. And when it comes to Drew McIntyre, I just think, like you said, he is a guy that is part of the ensemble cast. I think he's a guy that comes up in other people's stories. You know what I'm saying? In other people's, you know, big canon things. The first, you know, CM Punk returns to WWE. He has his first feud with Drew McIntyre and then he goes off to potentially challenge for the title at WrestleMania. We'll see what happens there. You know, those sort of things at the time of recording. I guess actually we'll find out by the time this comes out. You know, that idea of, I think, you know, and I think that historically significant, that canon ideology most comes in probably during the pandemic run for him. But again, you're talking about a year or maybe a year, year and a half for that that time period. And like you just said about, you know, feud of the year and best on the mic, which is very lackadaisical way of saying it. That is also historically significant. But the tough part about it all is we're looking at like 1 year, 2 years maybe for Drew McIntyre. And you're looking at the pantheon of Hall of Fame level careers. 1 to 2 spotty years to me is not going to be enough.
Well, even look, like I wrote a column last year about, you know, rating guys relative to their contemporaries.
What a transition is being up.
And, and comparing different generations, you know, looking at like, okay, how many Hall of Famers come in from different generations that were, you know, aged similarly, right?
Yeah.
But even when the reason I like to do that is because one was just to try to figure out like, okay, like standards in the industry changes over time. So it doesn't necessarily make sense to hold modern candidates to standards that reflect an industry that no longer exists and hasn't existed in a long time. And the point that I made in the column was, I brought up like Bill Russell and Will Chamberlain. For those who don't follow basketball, they're, you know, they were like two of the absolute best players of all time in basketball, but they played in the NBA in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And so like, if you look at their rebounding stats are absolutely insane. Like they're so much higher than everyone else that's ever played and ever will play, and nobody is ever going to touch them. And the reason for that is that, one, like, yeah, people like to say, oh, like they were like the only two tall guys back then, which isn't actually true. But a lot of it's just like the pace that the teams played at back then was faster than it was for most of the history in the NBA. And also they were far worse shooters then. So there was more rebounds. There were just so many more rebounds to get.
Yeah.
And they played, you know, they played all the games. They didn't have like, they didn't, you know, get injured as much, and they didn't like take, or maybe they did, but they just kept playing anyway. So they also played for a long time, even though like they didn't play more games than everybody, but they had very long careers with so many more rebounds available for them to get, and they got them, right? So that's why it's like, okay, you wouldn't say like someone's a bad rebounder now just because they don't compare to them. You'd compare them to, okay, like where do they rank relative to like the people that they played against, right? So even just doing that with Drew, like looking at like people that have been on the ballot and fell off, like, okay, like Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn were on last year. Uh-huh. They fell off. Like Seth Rollins has been on before and he fell off. So
Bray Wyatt.
Okay. Well, I was going to follow that up with, do you think Drew has a stronger case than those guys? You know, Bray Wyatt, I say maybe, probably.
I'll do a quick, this isn't a hot take. This isn't anything. I'm just going to say Bray Wyatt does have world title runs that are in front of people that we could actually track versus Drew McIntyre. I'm just going to put that. I'm not saying it's a better case. I'm not saying that at all. Listen to the last episode. I'm just saying that, you know, that we can better put something together on Bray Wyatt, even though I think it's bad.
It's sold a lot of those fiend belts or whatever.
I gotta hide them. I gotta hide them all behind me. I was quickly throwing things away. I quickly take off my hurt heel hands. but yeah, no, I agree. I one of the reasons I also brought you on, not only because I think you have great insight and I love talking with you, was I really enjoyed this article. It came out last year on voicesofwrestling.com. Are Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame voters too hard on modern candidates is the title. That's what I meant by teeing up a transition. One of the reasons I wanted to bring you on also is because I wanted to talk about this article with you. I think it was really well made argument for the sort of harshness isn't the word, but sort of this maybe larger limit we add to the most modern of modern candidates, that most modern generation of modern candidates, compared to even people that are in the modern U.S. and Canada category, but are able to, you know, have a lot more people of that generation. And I totally agree with that idea, ideology of comparing it to people within their generation. The business has changed significantly. I'm doing a series called Hustle Loyalty Retrospect. This is my little plug on patreon.com/countoutpod, where I'm going through the career every 2 years of John Cena. And I'm at this point in, and I just finished the script of the next episode, which has come out last month, confusingly. Next episode last month, about 2001 to 2002 for John Cena. And the career moves at such a lightning speed for John Cena, or not even John Cena, but like everyone in that period is crazy. He starts 2001 as a SoCal indie wrestler, and he ends 2002 a rapper on SmackDown, which so his entire OVW run is inserted in that as well. Inserted in that period, obviously, is WWF buying WCW, which took place 9 days after his last indie match. There's just this thing where the business is moving so quickly. By the time he gets to the main roster, Hogan's there, Kurt Angle has shaved his head bald, Brock Lesnar is the next big thing, and they're switching titles like constantly and moving quickly. My only point there is that the speed of wrestling back then, in terms of everything that's happening, is moving so quickly. Nowadays, you'll have people in developmental territories for years. Sami Zayn is someone, you know, mentioned in the Hall of Fame last year, in NXT for 3 years. And a lot of, I think, Hall of Famers will discount that. You know, John Cena started wrestling and went onto the main roster in 4 years. Sami Zayn was in NXT for three. And that's not counting any of that decade and a half that he had on the indies, obviously starting in 2002 for him. So I think there that sort of expansion of looking, you know, in all of this to say that the business has changed to a point where it has sort of slowed the developmental process for a lot of wrestlers to a certain degree. And it almost makes it that you should, I think, almost look at these smaller promotions, let's say, these more minor promotions like a TNA or a Ring of Honor, as better suitors for potential Hall of Famers, because the process of just moving up to the main roster of WWE has slowed down significantly as opposed to the 2000s.
Yeah, one thing to just really solidify your point there that I was just thinking, so it's 2025 this year. So 10 years ago was the main event of WrestleMania. It was Roman versus Brock with the Seth Rollins cash in, right? Yep. That doesn't feel like that long ago, right?
No.
But to your point, that's the same difference between 1995, which is Diesel versus Shawn Michaels, and yep, LT versus Bam Bam Bigelow, and John Cena winning his first world championship against JBL and Batista versus Triple H. That feels like an eternity, right? Yeah. Like, think about everything that happened in that 10 years.
Sami Zayn was on the indies and NXT for, I believe, 13 years. I throw up another one, a guy that constantly gets complained about for someone that is on developmental. Tyler Bate, a guy that was like in NXT UK and NXT proper for like 7 years, but also on the indies as well for five beforehand. John Cena starts wrestling in 1999. If he had the same sort of length of time as Sami Zayn of indies, NXT for 13 years, John Cena would not have debuted on the main roster of SmackDown until 2012, which is an insane idea to think about.
Well, do you remember there was some, oh my God, what show was it? I don't think it was MTV True Life, but it was something like, I just remember there was some show back then that was talking about like training wrestlers, and John Cena was on it.
Yes, I do know. I watched the Patreon episode. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So he's doing his prototype character back then. Yep. But when they show footage of him training in UPW, Samoa Joe is there.
Yes.
Like Samoa Joe's one of the trainees there. So it's like, that's actually, when they go the through, perfect. just say that's the perfect like comparison point for what you're talking about. Is
yeah,
we had John Cena and Samoa Joe like starting in the same place, and just the wildly different career arcs they had because of, I guess, differences in the industry and how they were perceived, right?
I don't remember if it was promo class or just like a separate scene in the documentary. Documentary was Inside Wrestling School, aired on the Discovery Channel. Fun fact. I don't remember if it was the promo class or a different scene, but Christopher Daniels shows up. You know, this being UPW be sort of a developmental indie for WWF. Christopher Daniels wrestled a lot of main events versus a lot of various people.
Like your must-watch list, our network is all over the place. Because T-Mobile helps keep you connected, from big cities to your hometown, on America's largest 5G network. Switch now, keep your phone, and T-Mobile will pay it off up to $800 per line via prepaid card. Visit your local T-Mobile location, or learn more at T-Mobile.com/keep-and-switch. Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device credit service port in 90-plus days. Device ineligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Nashville Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, where every nail-biting overtime win, breakaway, pick six, three-point shot, underdog win, buzzer beater, shootout, walk-off, and absolutely every play in between is amazing. From football to basketball and hockey to baseball, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call TN Redline. 1-800-899-9789. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Tennessee.
There's one match where it's Christopher Daniels versus Kurt Angle in UPW, which is the California indie that John Cena was in. I know a lot about this, Adam. Like I said, Hustle Loyalty Retrospect, patreon.com/countoutpod to listen to that. But yes, anyways, back to your article. This is not about me. This is about you.
Well, no. This is perfect because, if you think about the evolution of the industry, right, like, if you look back in the territory days, there were a lot more places to work that there just were, and especially a lot more like higher profile places to work. And that was just because that's the way the industry existed then, right? Like there wasn't cable television. Everything was localized. And then that a lot of wrestlers were able to have much more longer and productive careers, at least in terms of being a draw, because they could go from place to place. They would have their run. Once they started to get stale and fall down the card, oh, time to leave and go somewhere else, right? Like there were always like the guys who would stay in one place, and like, you know, a Jerry Lawler or, you know, people like that, you know, even the decades prior, because they were, you know, the guys like that the territories were built around. But, you know, for the most part, everybody else would, you know, just go from place to place, stay fresh, and then, you know, move up the cards. And they were incentivized to do that because that's their spot on the card and how well the territory was drawing. That was what dictated their pay. Right. So they were always incentivized to do that. Fast forward to, you know, the 2000s after ECW and WCW shut down, right? Like WWE is the only game in town. You know, I guess there's TNA as well, which, you know, TNA, I think TNA's problem is more like they just kind of got to a certain level and they kind of opened at a certain level. Once they got on Spike, they just kind of stayed at that same level for like their entire existence. There wasn't really a whole lot of ups and downs, I guess maybe from a profit and loss standpoint, but in terms of like their level of popularity didn't change too much, right? It wasn't that the joke, like they'd get like a million viewers. It didn't matter what they did. Like the rating was always the same.
Never able to convert people to the pay-per-views.
Well, that part was like that. There was definitely some poor creative choices in that. But yeah, like they do a million viewers and then like couldn't get 50,000 people to buy the pay-per-views outside of a couple occasions. So, but even then, like it's like okay, so in terms of the incentives for the wrestlers, right? Like they were incentivized to either get to TNA and stay there or get to WWE and stay there because that's where they could make their money. You know, somebody like, until like much, much later when, you know, like the indies had gotten built up and, you know, New Japan was bringing in, you know, New Japan was accessible in the US as well, and they were interested in expanding. And so like when Cody leaves, like that's kind of a turning point, right? When it's like, oh, like the indies are actually like, you know, you might be able to raise your stock by leaving WWE. But no one had really done that at that point, at least willingly. Like we just talked about Drew, like Drew actually was able to accomplish that, but he didn't do that of his own volition. He did that because WWE didn't want him anymore.
Yeah.
So I guess this all, and so I guess what this all ties back to is because there used to be so many more places where you could draw and make a difference, that it makes sense that there were so many more Hall of Famers, right? Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, like we're just kind of leaving out like significant careers in the industry by like comparing them against standards from like the territory era,
yeah.
Essentially, like, I think maybe the drawing period that you would need for a Hall of Famer, maybe that should be shortened, because if there's only a few places where you can be a Hall of Fame level draw, then inherently that place needs turnover on top because they can't have the same people on top forever. They need to rotate people in and out. That's just the nature of wrestling and how it works. So like, I think that's something that I think some voters might need to, it might be well served to, for them to reevaluate, like, okay, in terms of the time period of being a draw or on top, like what, even if it's more of an, like, maybe it's just a few months out of the year for a number of years, like you can aggregate that together and say, wow, this actually is, this is a lot, as opposed to, you know, looking at someone from the territory era where they might've been like a consistent Hall of Famer for literally decades. Like there's, yep. You know, there are a lot of people like that. So that's one aspect, right? I see we might need to reevaluate that a little bit for modern guys to be more fair to them, because if we don't, then there's just going to be like far fewer Hall of Famers, and a lot of like the purpose of the Hall of Fame is kind of tell the history of the industry, right? So I think there's a lot of guys who have like incredible careers and were significant in their time. Like just as an example, like is it, like with modern guys, like maybe like, you know, like let's just say like the 10th or like 15th best candidate, right? Like they're not in the Hall of Fame, but then you go back to other eras that might have, you know, 25 or 30 guys or 35 guys, you know, something like that.
In the piece you brought up Paul Orndorff being like the 27th and the 28th guy of like the 80s and 90s of that generation. Whereas Roman Reigns and the Young Bucks are 7 and 8,
yes,
in this the modern 2025 generation, let's say.
Yeah, I'd recommend people read it because it's easier once you see it. It's easier to make sense of it than it is to explain it.
It will be linked down below.
But basically, what I did was I took the I looked at I organized the Hall of Famers by what year they turned 35, or if they were a tag team, what year their tag team broke up, and organized it by like a rolling 10-year period. So just to see like, okay, so how many Hall of Famers raged 30, 35 between like, you know, this this like 20-year period and this 20-year period. And the reason I did it that way was because if you just do like arbitrary hard cutoffs, then you might end up with some like really weird results where like there's 1 year difference, but like one group has like, you know, 20 more people than another.
Yeah.
But what I saw was, so basically like every Hall of Famer is in, you know, two of the groupings. But basically it's like, okay, there's around like 30 Hall of Famers like in the 80s and prior, right? When all the territories are around. But then, you know, once you get into the 90s, it goes down to about 20. Once you get into the 2000s, it goes down to about 15. And then once you get into 2015, like it's even less than half of that. And now we're in 2025, and, you know, there'd only be like a couple. I think it would be just the Young Bucks, Roman and Bryan Danielson. So Like, it's just, it's basically just showing, like, okay, like, we're not keeping up. At least if the rate of Hall of Famers is supposed to be similar across eras, then we're not necessarily keeping up with that. And to some degree, to me, that makes perfect sense, because the Hall of Fame didn't start until 1996. And so a lot of its first, you know, 20 or 30 years, obviously, is going to be focused on catching up, right? Yeah. Like, okay, like, the industry has existed for, you know, 100 years. You know, we're trying to catch up and honor everybody that should be honored and inducted to really tell the story of the history of the industry, you know, who the best, who the biggest draws were, who the best workers were, who the most influential and historically significant figures were. But I think now we've gotten to a point where, okay, we've caught up pretty well. Like, if you look at the, at least, you know, looking at the historical US section, like, these are people who have been talked about a lot for a long time. And so some of them are still getting in. Like, seeing Johnny Rougeau get in last year was awesome. I thought he was very much deserving and long overdue. So it was nice to see that. There's still some other people that I feel that way about, but it's not most of the category. I'll just say that. So at this point, I think it's more, okay, like, let's also pay attention to the modern candidates, you know, give them a closer look, really think about, like, okay, what are the standards for this era? Who are the best workers of the era? Who are the biggest draws? Who are the most historically significant? Whether that be because they were so great at one thing or another, or because they changed the industry, and try to recognize, you know, the candidates more in real time. But yeah. I think it's just taken some time for, it always takes the voters, time to put current events into a historical context. Mm-hmm. So some people are more, some people do that more quickly than others, I'll say, but it's, that's something that everybody, I think every voter individually grapples with how to do that. And I think over time, like, some of these, once we see maybe how the industry changes a bit in the future, that might recontextualize some of the careers that have played out recently.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think comparing him generationally is good. And I think especially with 2024, 2025, especially how, like, WWE has changed. And you know, this being, it's one of the first real groups where we'll get a lot of that AEW, the era of people that aren't part of really a monopoly of wrestling, let's say. It'll be interesting to see how that all changes. I also went through and, you know, looked at all of the people that were in the Hall of Fame per generation, 2015, 2005, 1995, all the way down to 1955 that you had laid out. And I took percentages of people that were, that got in into the Hall of Fame, divided by people that are currently on the ballot or had dropped off. And it, not a shocking result based off of your thesis. Would you like to hear these percentages, Adam?
Sure. Yeah. I had no idea this was coming.
Oh yeah. I'm shocking you. I'm surprising you. Here we are. Obviously pre 1945, we're just going to skip that. 1955 is where we'll get that first one. 20. So just the example of the math, 29 people we have listed here in the Hall of Fame. The thing I'm looking at says 28, but obviously Johnny Rougeau is added to that list. I think now that I think about it, I think the person I forgot to add to all my math is, how am I forgetting his name? Memphis wrestler, teamed up with Jerry Lawler. Why am I forgetting his name? Bill Dundee.
Oh, Bill Dundee. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the only guy I'm forgetting. I forgot to put on here, but he wouldn't be 1955. Anyways, 1955, 29 people in the Hall of Fame. There are 16 that are either currently still on the ballot or has dropped off. So that means 64% of the people available to be voted on in 1955 are in the Hall of Fame. An insanely high number. Well, knowing that math, we'll go right ahead. 1965, 44% got in. 1975, 40% got in. 1985, 36% got in. 1995, 35% got in. So basically the same across those two generations. 2005, 38% got in. So a weird little bump up there. And then 2015, obviously the most recent of eras, 25% got in. 8 people are in the Hall of Fame. 24 are currently on or off the ballot. If Dave didn't add anyone else to that generation of ballot people, that for that percentage to match 2005 of 38%, we would need to vote in four more people that are currently on the ballot without Dave adding any more new people. And I think, you know, based on the people that you laid out as people that have never been on the ballot or not yet eligible, that would be part of this generation, these people are certainly going to be added to the ballot. So presumably that 25% that got in feels like it's going to get even smaller unless we, you know, voters start ramping up and start looking at, you know, generally looking at these newest candidates, not in comparison to, you know, like you said, the 80s, the 90s, even the early 2000s to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, and even within, because of the way like the modern ballot is structured, when it's not based on age, I mean, it's based on age to a degree to get added to it, but in terms of when you're moved to historical, it's based on relevancy.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of like guys who are pretty like the outsiders and the Steiner brothers are on the same ballot as like, you know, John Moxley and Becky Lynch and Sasha Banks, you know, Mercedes Moné. Like, you know, those are vastly different industries. And that's probably why some of the, generational comparisons and stuff, like it's still held to like prior era standards a bit, is because it does like the modern section does still takes up such a wide time period.
Yeah.
So I think that definitely plays into it a bit, but that's tough for voters though, because when you're prioritizing you're going to vote for it, because we only get, you know, like a handful, maybe five votes, you know, five, six votes for the category.
I believe this year it is five votes, obviously assuming Dave doesn't add anyone last second.
Yeah, which, you know, he does a lot of times.
Yeah,
so we'll see. But yeah, so it's, you know, you get like, okay, so I have like five votes. So am I going to prioritize like, I mean, I think, you know, like CM Punk and Cody would be like the two strongest guys from.
The section of the episode where I ask who you're going to vote for?
You might as well, because I'm going to go into it.
All right. I'll send you the list just so you have it in front of you.
Oh, I got it already.
Oh, perfect.
I got this all prepped.
He's come prepared, folks. this guy's in the weeds of the ballot, just like me. He's come prepared.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the ballot, I would say, or at least like what the projected ballot is, I would say like Punk and Cody, like they were the two highest in modern U.S. Canada that didn't get in last year like 52-48% for both of them.
Correct.
So I would expect them to get, based on that trajectory and also both of them having like really strong years again, like I would expect them to both get in. You never know with Punk though. Phil's got a lot of haters. And also he might like, I don't know, kick a baby or something between now and September. So
we'll find out. But I think especially with, then you also have three people of that category, Orndorff, Reigns, and Young Bucks, all those votes have essentially freed up. Those are going to go somewhere. Well, you know, obviously that's, I think it was like seven last year. Now it went down to five, maybe back up to six. We'll see. But like those votes are going to have to go somewhere. And it makes sense to me that they'll probably go to at least Punk and Cody.
Yeah, I would expect that as well. But then after that, I mean, it's everyone else has wildly different cases. Like, you know, we talked about brought upon naturally, or like they're at 21%. So I don't anticipate them, like, you know, going in, but just like comparing Hall and Nash to Jay and Mark Briscoe, like those are polar opposite cases, and it's like completely different time periods. Or like, you know, comparing Goldberg to Becky Lynch, or you know, like, or you know, like FTR's coming up, right? Like FTR versus the Steiner brothers, who I actually think there's some similarities there, but just in completely different time periods, right? Yeah. So it's like, how do you weigh all this stuff and who do you prioritize, right? Like it gets really hard. Like there's only a couple of people that stand out, and like Punk and Cody are the only ones to me that like really completely stand out over everybody else. And then it's more like, okay, just like, what do you weigh? Like, what do you value the most? Well, I guess one is, do you think any of these other candidates are worthy at all, right? But then if you do, then what do you weigh and what do you prioritize exactly when like the time periods that they wrestled in and their cases are all so different from each other?
It feels like we're also, part of the articles that you wrote on Voice of Wrestling is sort of circling this potential theory of, I guess I'll just call like an innate bias in some of the voting body of not voting for the newer people, and a lot of it going down to, I'll say pre WCW purchase, pre Monopoly era in wrestling. Obviously, Roman Reigns and Young Bucks going in kind of destroy that a little bit, but you know, we're ignoring that for right now. But like this idea of maybe this potential any bias or this preference, and where do you think that comes from in the voting body? It's tough to say, obviously, because we don't know everybody that's in the voting body. But why do you think there seems to be evidence to suggest that there is some sort of bias here?
I think the primary thing is,
I should say, if you think it's a bias.
Well, I think it's a bias, but I don't think it's like, I don't even know if it's, I wouldn't even say conscious. It could be subconscious to some degree, but I think the bias is just being able to put current events into historical context. I think that's the, like, it takes people a while to do that, right? Like Sting's a great example, right? Like Sting's career was, people thought of, like, this thing didn't get a lot of traction for a long time, right? As a candidate, like some of that was because like the competition back then, like again, we're catching up on inducting people, right? That was part of it, but then also people thought
some of that is like some of that is Dave saying no,
yeah. Some of that was people just thinking, you know, viewing Sting as a failure, but then I think over time people reassess that because it was like, oh wait, like he's still relevant and like is a difference maker to one degree or another, like. So many years later. So was the problem really him, or was it, you know, like the, you know, like the industry he was, more specifically the promotion he was in at the time, is that why he wasn't as successful, right?
To me with, you know, that sounds weirdly similar to like a guy like Samoa Joe, like a guy that is that has significance in a lot of fashion, but like it feels mostly on the promotion that he works for at the time.
Yeah, Joe's a great guy to talk about that with, because he's someone who reached the main event everywhere he worked, like no matter where it was. And then, you know, he wasn't always like their biggest draw, but he was, you know, he did reach the main event everywhere he worked, and he did a lot of great work too. And I think with him, like one of the things I'll say about him is that I think there was, you know, at least there's like a 4-year period where he was one of the absolute best wrestlers in the world. And I think actually there was like a 1 or 2 year period where he was the best wrestler in the world, which I think helps him both from an in-ring and historical significant standpoint, because not a lot of people can say that. But so yeah, but that's an example, right? Like I think how Sting's career over time got looked at differently. I think a lot of these careers currently that are for wrestlers in Canada that are on the ballot are going to be looked at differently over time as well. Not just from a drawing perspective, but I think from a work perspective too, because like to your point about John Cena shooting up and becoming like a, you know, a megastar really quickly.
Mm-hmm. 4 years after he graduated college, by the way, fun fact.
Yeah. But so back then that was, so he got on the track that I think a lot of prospects are going to get on now, that AEW is competing for wrestlers with WWE. So people get signed a lot earlier than they used to. When we talk about like the career of the Briscoe brothers or Samoa Joe or Sami Zayn, who spent, you know, like a decade or two, you know, outside like a WWE or AEW size promotion, like that's never going to happen anymore. Like the reason the indies were so incredible from a work rate perspective for so long was because WWE, and more specifically Vince McMahon, had a very narrow view of who could be a star. And there were people like CM Punk and Bryan Danielson and, you know, Seth Rollins, Kevin Owens, who changed that over time. But he just wasn't interested in these wrestlers who were absolutely incredible, who had so many years of working all over the world, and again, so they were growing together too and working against each other to put together these massive portfolios of incredible work before they even got on the national stage. And as long as AEW and WWE both exist and are doing well, we're not going to see that anymore. Yeah. So the work profiles and resumes that people are going to be put together are only going to be, at least the most significant parts of it, they're only going to be, you know, what they did on AEW or WWE or NXT or ROH, whatever. They're only going to be what they did in those two promotions because, or I guess in Japan, if they go to Japan or Mexico or something like that, right? But they're only going to be in those places because they're just going to get signed so early. Mm-hmm. Like they're only going to have, like once somebody starts working at like, can you imagine if like 2004 Samoa Joe and CM Punk were like around now? Like, I mean, they get signed. I mean, they get signed so quickly and probably pushed on TV too.
Yeah,
like they wouldn't have lasted. Like, they wouldn't have lasted. Like, well, I guess they both went to like TNA and WWE the next year, so maybe they weren't the best examples. But maybe actually, like Sami Zayn, like right, yeah. Like Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens and the Briscoe brothers in 2007, right? Like those guys aren't going.
Sami Zayn's a guy that starts wrestling in 2002. As all of this stuff is really like coming to an end, basically, and he's kind of maybe there's a Canada aspect to it as well, but things start like slowing down significantly, like right at 2002.
Yeah, like those are just example. Like those four guys, they're not waiting. Like, well, the Briscoes didn't get signed. Well, that for a number of reasons, but. Yeah. But like Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens, like it's not going to take them like over 5 years for like a major promotion to pick them up now if they weren't having like what they were doing in 2007. Or got Bryan Danielson. Like Bryan Danielson is not waiting to get signed until like 2010, right? If he was doing what he was doing in the early and mid 2000s. But I think that's going to recontextualize like how we view those work portfolios going forward, because like the AEW wrestlers don't, and WWE now, they don't wrestle as many matches, right? And they might not be pushed all the time.
Yeah.
So they might not have as many opportunities. So they'll still do like probably great high level stuff, right? So it ranks highly like within end of year awards and things like that. But the volume isn't necessarily going to be there, you know, unless you're Will Ospreay, but that's a different conversation.
That does make me think that like, and this is a whole another conversation for another day, but like, it feels like that would then lead to a decrease in like sort of the wrestling in-ring working ability, right? If you have people that are, you know, like I said, with John Cena, obviously, as an example, and he is a guy that graduates college, then in the fall starts wrestling on the indie scene. And then I believe 2 years later, or really a year later, gets like a developmental contract with WWF. And then 2 years, you know, a year after that, he shows up in OVW. And then a year after that, he's on the main roster. Like if we're back to sort of, or if we start shifting back, I should say, to a time period where more people are getting signed faster in terms of their development process, that almost feels like we're going to start shifting towards a decrease in wrestling ability, because these are people that will have less years of experience, naturally, yes, less years of experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a real risk of that happening. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that's something, I don't think we can see it just yet, because
I think we're in that transition. I think we're currently in that transition.
Yeah, because AEW's only been around for, you know, 5-6 years now. So a lot of the guys who, even the younger guys, like they still had time on like that really hot, deep indie scene that we were talking, like Daniel Garcia, for an example. Like, yeah. You know, he's still been wrestling a while. He's young, but he's been wrestling a while. So he was around in like the latter half of the, you know, the 2010s. So yeah. he did get a lot of work in. You know, against some really good people for a while, and that helped him prepare to take advantage of the opportunities when he eventually got them, right? So we haven't really seen a whole lot of, like, the people AEW training from scratch, like, you know, Jade Cargill and Hook, and, like, you know, they're not going to be Hall of Fame workers like anytime soon, if ever, yeah. Right? So, and, you know,
but even to that extent, we'll never know, because they've only been wrestling for 3-4 years or so. So, like, you know, John Cena, 3-4 years is in OVW still. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that, well, wait, hold on. It, you said what?
They're still so early in the career that, like, you never know. Maybe Jade and or Hook will be the next John Cena. But when you compare it to what they were in versus like a guy like John Cena, and I keep bringing him up, but he was a guy that, like, at that point in time is like still in OVW training. Like, they're still in the long stretch of history of professional wrestling, very green. And so they could maybe get there potentially, maybe 2 decades from now, they're the hottest star. We just, you know, how the hell do we know right now?
I take that bet.
I tend to agree with you, but we'll find out.
someone like Nick Wayne though, like, right. Like he did a lot of matches on the indies. He's really good, has a lot of potential.
Yep.
He's really good right now, honestly. Like, they could push him way more than they do. But, you know, like, how, okay, so, like, he's on AEW TV. He plays a role, right? And maybe he does become, over time, like this, you know, like, hey, one of the best wrestlers in the world, and puts together, like, a Hall of Fame work resume. But even if he does that, like, he's not necessarily going to have like the volume of high level work that, a Sami Zayn did, even if he's a comparable, which I mean, I don't think he's necessarily going to become Sami Zayn, because that's absurdly high standard that I would never hold anyone to. But even if he did, like, right, he's not going to have the same volume because he signed with AEW relatively early. He's only going to have so many matches a year. And he spent a couple years, you know, kind of being Christian's lackey as he's developing. Right.
Yeah.
So I think, if we see that, I think when, like, over time, those are going to be the comparison points. And then we say, oh, historically, like, yeah, these guys who had these like incredible, like, work rate careers that lasted for decades are significant historical outliers. Right. Yeah. And then that reframes, because right now there's just a lot of guys kind of similar to that. Mm-hmm. Or not a lot, but, you know, a lot of them on the ballot at the same time, or have been on the ballot recently. But once, like, the generation following that starts to come up and become eligible, and then they're compared to those guys, that might help them stand out a bit more. Kind of like how Sting's, you know, ability as a draw started to look a lot better when you looked at the generation that followed him, where it was much harder to make a difference in the industry. The difference that he made retrospectively, like, was much more impressive contextually. So I think that's just something I've thought about a lot, like, while I was writing that and after I wrote that. So anyway, it's nice to be able to talk to it and really explore it in a lot of depth here.
One last thing before we go, and we talk about other things or plugs and whatnot. I wanted to ask it, especially in light of that article, looking at more of like the more modern folks and having this sort of discussion about like looking at these other companies, that these non-WWE companies, especially in the last 20 years. How do you think a group like the Young Bucks getting in, do you think that changes anything? Do you think that looks more shine towards Ring of Honor? Maybe not TNA for their case, but, you know, Ring of Honor, obviously AEW as well. I think now we can sort of, them going in, there's an element of AEW being a historically significant company, certifiably. How do you think them going in sort of changed the hopeful outlook on these sort of more smaller promotions in the 2010s?
Yeah, I don't. That's interesting, because the Young Bucks, one, they have such a historical significance because of creating AEW.
Yes.
And also they have historical significance from just being such a great tag team for such a long period of time.
On the quote unquote indies.
Right, right. For and New Japan. That was the other thing, though. They were in New Japan too. Like, it wasn't just, but yeah, you know, most of their work was on the indies too. So it's so they have those two things going for them, which gives them like a historical significance. I don't necessarily like I brought up like Samoa Joe being like one of the best wrestlers in the world for a few years. You can say that gives him historical significance. He didn't necessarily like change the industry though. Well, some people might argue he did in some way, but. Mm-hmm. I would hope that, yeah, that opens the door for at least work to be considered, for work that was rated, that really resonated and was rated high level in real time for a team like the Briscoe Brothers, as an example. I would hope that opens the door for them. I do think there's still a, you know, just like there's tribalism between WWE and AEW fans, I do think there's, I don't want to call it tribalism, but I do think there's kind of like a, it does impact, I think, how certain voters assess candidates, like both those who were in WWE and those who like spent most of their career or all of their career outside WWE.
Yeah.
As well, because I think it's, you know, like one side might have an opinion where, oh, it's just the brand that draws for WWE. It didn't matter who was on top. And, you know, my counter to that is, well, then why did we see all these fluctuations in the brands depending on who was on top during different times, right? And then other guys would say, like, oh, well, you know, these guys never, you know, didn't draw anything. It's like, well, because they worked in smaller promotions. It's like, well, okay, but like in the Young Bucks case, they led to the creation of AEW, which then did, you know, did the Wembley show, which is, you know, depending on who you're talking to, either the most attended show of all time, or at least in like the top 3 to 5, you know, depending on how much you want to include North Korea.
Depending what tattoos you read out there.
Or which day you check Wikipedia.
No, I agree. I hope that it leads to it. I do agree that I think, I don't want to necessarily say strongest is historical significance, because obviously wrestling ability is up there for them. But I think I hope this opens more doors to that conversation, because I think when you're looking at that most modern generation, that 2015 generation that you lay out, a big part of that generation is the, you know, talking about the canon of professional wrestling, a big part of that is this indie boom. Of the 2010s, you know, looking at, you know, I'll throw TNA, but TNA, Ring of Honor, Dragon Gate USA as well, I'll throw in there. Now that with Shimo, Dragon Gate is a historically significant promotion. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there is, that is part of it. And to sort of disregard it, flippantly maybe disregard it in some cases, feels like a bad idea in my opinion, but I guess we'll ultimately see.
I certainly get, like, okay, maybe from a drawing perspective it doesn't necessarily help, right, so someone's case, but you know, if they went on to be a big draw, you know, maybe, you know, you look at that and say, oh, you know, maybe they look a little closer, you know, maybe they were making differences there, right? And then went on to do something bigger. Actually, you could apply to Drew, just because, you know, he helped definitely. And when he was, you know, in the UK during those years he was out, he definitely helped some different promotions grow. Like the UK scene got very hot. Mm-hmm. And he was a part of that. He was a part of growing that, you know. It really peaked. It peaked after he left, but he was definitely a part of. Well, that's not, but he went back to WWE, right? Like they wanted to bring him back, right? But he was a big part of growing that. And, you know, similarly, if you look at, you know, you brought up Dragon Gate, you know, that's in Japan, so, you know, not really modern US, but, you know, Shima, obviously that's one of the reasons he got it, was because he grew the promotion from, you know, zero to, I guess, you know, you could say Toriyumon before it, but he also outgrew Toriyumon. So even if you consider that them the same thing or different, he was, you know, the primary drawing card for both for a really long time. So yeah, I would say at least, but even if you don't want to look at it from a drawing perspective, you at least have to say, like, okay, the work in these places mattered, because it was where the innovation was happening, and it also resonated in real time. Like, people were watching it. It influenced like the style of everywhere, right? Like especially Ring of Honor. And Ring of Honor did have, you know, that was a, you know, pretty large platform. You know, for a while. So I'd say, at least from a work perspective, I think, yeah, those places that should definitely count and be considered. And hopefully that does help, you know, a candidate like the Briscoe Brothers, who, just in terms, again, like when I was bringing up before, in terms of volume, have like an absolutely incredible volume of great matches for, you know, 2 decades together.
All right, I guess last two questions here to tie it all back to the ballot here. Drew McIntyre, yes or no, would you vote for him this year to be inducted into the Hall of Fame based on what we discussed?
I will not be. Not this year, but I think he might fall off, just similar to Owens and Zayn. But based on the way his career is going, he'll probably get added back in the future and we'll reevaluate then.
If the trajectory keeps going upwards, or at least laterally, then I presume he will also fall off. I imagine if the direction continues, then he'll probably get put back on at some point. There's a whole other aspect we could have discussed about, if things are getting longer and development processes are getting longer, that sort of goes hand in hand with a conversation about like extending the age threshold. But that is a whole other conversation that we probably don't have time for. That's next year's episode. Talking about the age quandary. Then the last little bit here is we kind of started it. Got distracted by a bunch of other things, but you had 5 votes. Who would you vote in? If not for Drew McIntyre, who would you vote in on this ballot? And if you want to do a bonus 6 just potentially, then you can as well.
So I would say the people I voted for last year, that I voted for Punk and Cody. I'll vote for them again. I voted for Samoa Joe last year. I'll probably do that again. Because I'm, like I said, he's the best wrestler in the world for a while, and that's historically significant, and obviously in ring as well. And then I voted for Jon Moxley last year. Jon Moxley's fascinating because people always say like, oh, you don't want to vote for people too soon, right? And yeah. I've always been a very strong proponent of, no, when people are over the line, they're over the line. Like, it doesn't matter. And mm-hmm. I think he crossed the line already. I voted for him the last 2 years. I think, or at least last year, if I did, I think I voted from the year before, because I think he was vital to AEW being successful early on. And without him, maybe maybe they don't get that TV deal before COVID hits, and then they're gone, right? And also, just he did a lot of great work for a really long time. But he's definitely testing my theory and my conviction on that stance this past year. So we'll see if
he's a strong 2019 to 2023. We can all agree.
Yeah, he's really testing my resolve and conviction on that stance. I'll probably still vote for him, but I don't know. There's still a long way to go. We'll see how much he pisses me off between now and then, or disappoints me. After that, I think probably the Briscoe brothers, I think, mm-hmm. just, because they were so great for so long. So I think probably them. So I think that those are probably my top 5. But look, I always love reading people's cases and seeing that might sway me one way or another. And, maybe we get another vote and, somebody else something happens, this year. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. I don't know if the Hardy Boys are going to if the Hardy Boys help TNA boom this year, maybe I'll vote for them. I don't know. We'll see.
I guess there's an argument for the TNA boom. I almost put it more on Joe Hendry, as much of a Joe Hendry fan I am not. There's maybe an argument for Joe Hendry as well, but I don't know.
Yeah, I that was, that was more tongue-in-cheek, but TNA, they're doing better than they have in a while.
They expanded their business. We got to look at which stars are popular, which stars are drawing to allow them to expand their business, right?
Hey, we just talked about considering the smaller being effective in the smaller promotions. And also, I guarantee you, the strongest Hardy Boys proponents will be bringing this up in six months or so from now. Get ready.
And of course, as a Matt Hardy fan, that will be you. Adam, thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming onto the ballot. This is a only man project. I very much appreciate you coming on to the ballot for the second time around. And I can't wait to have you on next year for, let's look at list. Who would be a rough person to put on? I don't know. I don't know who that would be next year. We'll find out, I guess. Adam, where can people find you and what plugs do you have for the good people at home?
Yeah, I would just say, my work's up at voiceswrestling.com. You can just search Adam Berger, Voices of Wrestling. You can go to my author page. You'll see what columns I have. I don't write all the time, but when I do, it's usually about the Hall of Fame or taking a look at some big picture stuff in the industry. So yeah, you know, feel free to check that out. I'm a frequent guest on the Gentleman's Wrestling podcast hosted by Jesse Collings. So feel free to check that out. Jesse always has a lot of interesting thoughts about that. Even if I don't agree with them, I'm always interested in what he has to say. Mm-hmm. And he has a lot of great, thoughtful guests on that as well. So yeah, check out those. And then in parting, I know this is always about the new candidates, but I will just say vote for Hayabusa this year and read the things that I've written about him and will continue to write about him.
Do you think, just real quickly, do you think Shima getting in has made you more of a flag waver for Hayabusa?
I was always a flag waver for Hayabusa, yes. But I think, similar to what you were saying about do the Young Bucks open the door, I think Shima getting in should definitely help open the door. And he was over 50. He was over 50% last year. Yeah. And I would just like to say, the majority of his support comes from wrestlers. When you look at the ballot breakdown, yep. So when we talk about significant, like historical significance in a positive manner, and particular the piece of that is influencing the industry and wrestling style and future generations, the wrestlers who vote in the Hall of Fame are literally telling us he meets that criteria. And I think the reporters who vote need to do a better job of recognizing that.
There we go, folks. The Hayabusa, the mini Hayabusa case coming at you live on the ballot. Well, again, Adam, thank you very much for coming on to the ballot. I'll see you next year talking about some other random wrestler with a subpar case, we'll say.
Can't wait.
Get rev your engines, everybody. All right, we'll talk to you all later next month, talking about an all new, brand new candidate on the ballot. Until then, have a good day, everybody. Goodbye.
This has been a Count Out Podcast.
Ring Post Radio is the only show hosted by Ryan Knightsey and Scotty Edwards that talks about the entire world of professional wrestling. With new episodes coming out every Sunday, there is absolutely no reason to not listen to real, honest wrestling opinions from two crazy maniacs. Have a hot boy summer and listen along to Ring Post Radio every Sunday on the Count Out Network.
Like your must-watch list, our network is all over the place. Because T-Mobile helps keep you connected, from big cities to your hometown, on America's largest 5G network. Switch now, keep your phone, and T-Mobile will pay it off up to $800 per line via prepaid card. Visit your local T-Mobile location or learn more at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch. Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device credit service port in 90 plus days. Device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Nashville Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.